And I was reminded of many years ago, just for the fun of it, I decided to talk on the second law of thermodynamics and make it a devotional subject. It seemed a challenge, but really it wasn't at all. Because according to the second law of thermodynamics, everything in the universe is supposed to be gradually losing heat, gradually sort of running out of steam, and the truth of that is that it means that everything is gradually, having been created and brought out of spirit, sinking back into the oneness of spirit. This is life. Yogananda said one time, there was one of the monks asked him, "Will I ever leave the spiritual path?" And he said, "How could you? Everyone in the world is on the spiritual path." And that is the truth, that even though we don't see it, even though it doesn't look as if people are on the spiritual path, it looks as if many are running pell-mell in the opposite direction. The truth is, everybody, without realizing it, is seeking the same thing. Yogananda explained it this way. He said that everybody in the world is looking for two things. One, how to avoid pain. Two, how to find happiness. And everybody is motivated this way. A problem that people run into is that they don't understand the nature of happiness. They think that happiness is, first of all, just getting rid of the pain. It's sort of like if I squeeze my hand long enough, hard enough, and finally let go, it feels so good. So to many people, happiness is simply that kind of relief. Also, many people think of happiness as an emotional high, an opposite to the negative state of pain. But the truth is that as long as you're going in that direction of trying to go toward opposites, it's sort of like a pendulum. If you have a pendulum that's gone too far in, let us say, the direction of pain, what you want to do is push it in the direction of happiness, not realizing that a pendulum's nature is to keep swinging. And the farther you push it one way, the farther it will have to push, have to move, swing in the opposite direction. These are simple facts of life. And so it was that God, in creating this universe, had to bring it out of something. You can't just say out of nothing. He brought it out of his consciousness. And his consciousness was one, undivided, eternally at rest. In order to create this universe, he had to create the appearance of movement, of manifestation, which is based on the principle of vibration. And without vibration, you would not have creation. With vibration, you have opposites, waves that go up and down. And so, like the pendulum going left and right, the vibrations of life are forever going up and down. If a person thinks, and this is the delusion that everybody falls into for a long time of seeking in the worldly sense, everybody falls into the thought that, well, if I can push that wave higher, I'll finally have it. Well, mind you, you don't change the level of the ocean by creating high waves. The ocean's level is always the same. Whenever you have a high wave, you have to have a compensating trough. The wave, the level of the ocean doesn't change, but where there's a high wave, there has to be a trough. And it's the simple nature of this world that for every emotional high, you're going to have an emotional low. It's just not, you can't escape it. I had a very amusing incident, thinking of it because Vidura is here. Back many years ago, I'd always dreamed of getting a motorhome. And I'd always dreamed of going around the country and talking to people and singing and so on from this motorhome. Well, back in about 1978, we got the opportunity to get a motorhome. I have to admit, because I it goes contrary to everything I know to let myself loose and really get high about something and really delight in something. I always know that if you allow yourself to go emotionally one way, you're going to have to go in the opposite direction. It's just the law of life. Like in college, I remember reading Hemingway's The Sun Also Rises. And what struck me most was that after a night of a lot of excitement and partying and so on, the loneliness and the desolation of a person's own personal room, and how opposite that was to the evening before. Life is like that. Well, when I got that motorhome, I just was absolutely delighted. I lay back and I laughed and laughed. I said, I know I'm going to have to pay for this, so I'm going to enjoy it anyway. When you don't have desires, the law acts more quickly. And sure enough, that same evening, Vidura was he was at the controls, and he forgot that it was in gear because it didn't seem to be moving. So he got up and went back to the refrigerator to get something. I was perched on one knee, reaching up to get something. So one foot on the ground, one knee on the bed, and trying to reach up like this when the motorhome hit the wall of a Safeway supermarket. We were in a parking lot. And it threw me on the floor, broke a finger, and I laughed all over again. I said, this is the way it is. I knew it had to happen. It did happen. You will see that this is the law of life. Well, what happens is this, that bit by bit, you begin to think there's something fishy going on. Because the more I get happy about something, the more I find I suffer. Whereas if I can be calm about it, I don't suffer so much. And the people in the beginning, you know that poem of Edna St. Vincent Millay, that I burn my candle at both ends, it will not last the light, but ah, my foes and oh, my friends, it gives a lovely light. Well, it doesn't. That's the whole problem. You think it's giving a lovely light, but it doesn't. It's a gray, amber, sort of a sick kind of light. And you know, you get a mosquito bite, and it scratches. And you know, it sort of feels good, doesn't it? But it also hurts. Well, that's the way of the pleasures of this world. They feel kind of good, and at the same time, they hurt. There's something unpleasant, and yet we like it. And so we get drunk, or we go out and have a high time, and there's always something like that, song in Mexican back in the 40s, Bésame mucho, como si fuera esta noche la última vez. Kiss me as though this were the last time ever. Well, you know, that's really just about what a kiss is like. It's just about what every human fulfillment is like. Well, I'll grab it while I can because I know it won't last. It doesn't. Nothing lasts. And after a while, you begin to think, wait a minute, I'd like to find something that doesn't have such extreme opposites. And you learn over a few incarnations, yes, but gradually you learn that when you can take things calmly, something else takes over. Because you see, the truth of it is that you don't really enjoy anything except to the extent that you give it joy. You have in your mind, now why do they say one man's meat is another man's poison? Why? I mean, if any particular food, let's say curry dinner, because I had one this evening, if that gave happiness in itself, and forgive me, Asha, you did cook it well, never mind. If that in itself gave happiness, everybody would like curry dinner. But I bet you there are some people here, maniacs, obviously, but a few people. Deficient, yes, yes, but never mind. That don't like curry. In fact, I remember one boy, he was a monk in the monastery there, and I saw him eating curry one time, and I said, I thought you didn't like curry. He said, yeah, I know, I don't like it, but Master says that if you like curry, you'll be reborn in India. And so... and so he was trying to get himself to like curry, thinking that that would make him be reborn in India. Of course, it takes a little bit more than liking curry to be born in India. I don't think he quite got the philosophy down pat, you might say. Nevertheless, it's so that it's your idea that makes you think that something will be food or poison, pleasurable or unpleasurable. And you certainly know this from life, that things that you absolutely love, other people can't stand to be around. Some kinds of music, some kinds of jokes, some kind of beautiful scenery, whatever it might be, like somebody who was thinking it was wonderful to see all those great big posters advertising soup and cigarettes and God knows what else in the midst of the beauties of nature. Oh, it adds a little color. Well, I have to say that according to my taste, it doesn't. Or it adds the wrong kind of color. But you can't argue with tastes. Why? Because you give the idea of what you're going to get to that thing. You think it's going to give you happiness. It satisfies an idea in your mind. And as a result, you think you're making yourself happy. And so, here you are. Let's look at it sort of in a typical way. You're walking down the street. The sun is shining. The birds are singing. Everything is going just beautifully. You feel on top of the world. And you pass a store window and there's, let's say, a dress there that just really takes your fancy. Or, assuming you're a man and not a woman, let's say maybe it's a new camera or who knows what. And you think, oh, wow, that's pretty nice, huh? And then you keep walking. You say, well, gee, the price tag is a little too high. I couldn't handle it. But about 50 yards down the road, you begin to find that the birds aren't singing quite so noisily or so sweetly. The sun may be shining, but it isn't quite so enjoyable. What's the matter? Well, you know, that memory. And finally you decide, I've got to have that dress or that camera. And so you think, well, my bank account won't allow me yet, but so you work harder. Maybe you get two jobs, whatever it is. You finally get this dream dress or this dream camera. And for a few days, you just enjoy the color, the shape, the pictures you can take, whatever it might be. After a few days, it begins to sort of settle back into a normal pattern of your life. You have all these things, perhaps too many of them. And so how do you keep getting that high? Show it to your friends. Get them to say how wonderful it is. Oh, yeah, it really is wonderful, isn't it? So for another week or two, you persuade yourself that this is great. After a while, even that begins to die down. And before the pain sets in, you begin to get some new idea. Well, if not a dress, then a coat. If not a camera, maybe a movie camera, whatever. And so it is from one desire to the next. We're constantly running after things that we think are going to make us happy. Now, sooner or later, you begin to think, well, wait a minute. I'm pretty well off as it is. I don't need all those things. You begin to feel suffocated by too much, like that song from Porgy and Bess, I got plenty of nothing, and nothing's plenty for me. And you realize that the less you have, maybe the happier you are. And so happiness no longer begins to seem something outside that you have to get excited about. It's a state. It's an inner state. Now, the more you come, mind you, the more that pendulum is brought to a still point at the center, the more you have, not boredom, oh yeah, that's another alternative, but more than that, you find that when you really are centered in yourself, you're never bored. You can see a little child, 3 years old, looking at a blade of grass and an ant crawling up that blade of grass. He can be absolutely absorbed in that simple little experience. We don't think that way because we've got too many excitements. And yes, children manage too. I'm giving you a kind of idealized example. But I remember in a barber shop in Rome where the barber, I guess, wanted to entertain himself, if not us, I don't know, but he had the television on. What struck me, I don't know how the television is in this country, I never watch television anyway, but I was watching this television out of the corner of my eye, and I noticed that every 2 seconds the scene changed. It had to keep you excited. Well, after a while, excitement ceases to be a synonym for happiness. And you think, the more I can have a little peace, the more I can be a little quiet. Bit by bit, you come to understand that happiness is an internal thing. It has nothing to do with outside excitements or fulfillments. It's something that you are. Now, once you begin to understand that, you see that everybody in the world is seeking that which this is. Everybody wants this inner peace. They just don't know it. They still think that they can find it through excitement. When the noise dies down, when everything, all the excitement stills, then they begin to see that, really, I'm happy as I am. I remember one time when I was new on the spiritual path, I went up with a friend of mine, Norman his name was. We climbed Mount Waterman in Southern California. Now, Mount Waterman is not a climbing kind of mountain. I don't mean it that way. And we drove most of the way up there. So really, it was not climbing, but it was being there. And we sat on a rock and watched the sun go down in the west. And there was this beautiful golden light in the valley. But the moon, the full moon, was coming up in the east. And on this side of the same scene, there was this wonderful icy blue light on the mist in those valleys. And this contrast between the gold light and the blue and this gradual shift. It was entrancing. And I remember Norman looking at it with me after a while. He said, if only I could feel it. You know, you see something like this and you think, gosh, I wonder what's for supper. Or why am I so uncomfortable? Or why are these damn mosquitoes around when I'm trying to enjoy myself? One time out at the lake shrine, Yogananda's lake shrine in Pacific Palisades, we were getting the place set up for a big opening. And it was so lovely. And yet there were these gnats that get in your eyes and ears, and you hardly dare inhale for fear of inhaling one of them. I said, sir, why is it in this perfect setup, perfect setting, do we have to have these gnats? And he said, that's God's way of keeping us always moving toward Him. Nothing in this world is going to ever be perfect. We have to just accept that. The more perfect, the more imperfect it is. Sooner or later, you reach the point where you know that the answers you're looking for haven't anything to do with this world. You're never going to find, this is one of the mistakes people make. I've read lots of books on utopias and ideal communities of one type or another. And the authors always have this delusion that you can find perfection outside yourself in the perfect setup, beautiful nature, beautiful people, beautiful everything, wonderful rules to make you toe the line. That's enough to kill it right there. But I've always known life isn't like that. It can't be. And so when I set out to build Ananda, I never tried to create the perfect place. I said, let's just try to make something better than we've got. Well, that's realistic. That's possible. And you know, several books came out talking about communities back in the late 60s, early 70s. And talked about Ananda as selling out. We were too willing to compromise instead of having this great ideal of earthly perfection. Every one of them has failed. Only Ananda is there. And the ideal that we set for ourselves, we keep pushing it higher and higher. Ananda's getting better and better. Because you don't look for perfection as if the curtain had suddenly come down and that was it. You look for something better, and you find that once it's better, you know the direction to go, and it gets better and better. But it will only get better to the extent that you have this inside yourself. Now, what is this? Yogananda said that the dual goals of life are to escape pain and to find happiness. But I've said also, and it's very clear from all our experience, that if we seek our happiness outside, we're going to have pain outside. The more we find our fulfillments outwardly, the more we're going to have disappointment and disillusionment outwardly. And so we come to discover gradually more and more that this happiness is something inside ourselves. Now it's not just, and this is an important point to understand, it's not just a definition. Happiness is not, I mean, how can you define happiness? If you ask the average person, are you happy? He's probably going to say, well, let's see, I'm not in the hospital. I've paid off most of my debts. Yeah, I'm happy. Happiness is not that. Happiness is something that you really feel. It makes you want to sing. It makes you feel high. One of the things, I have a t-shirt that says, angels can fly because they take themselves lightly. I've always liked that saying. I'm not one to go around with sayings blazoned on t-shirts, but this one I wear to bed at night. It's one I bought at East West, actually, many years ago. But if you can take yourself lightly, now that's one of the things. You see, what prevents us from finding this happiness inside is what Sri Yukteswar used to call the meannesses of the heart. The meannesses of the heart all relate to the thought of ego. I don't like this, I'm proud of this, I'm proud of that. Pride of pedigree, pride of family, pride of intelligence, pride of education. You know, it was an interesting thing for me how I came toward the spiritual path. As a child, I was very happy. But gradually, as I got educated, I found I was less and less happy, and more seeking definitions of how to be happy. And I spun all these marvelous intellectual theories about how to be happy, and I found that I was getting more and more miserable. And I remember looking back to my childhood and thinking, that's what I want. I want to be simple like a child. I want to get away from all this intellectual defining. And so that's when I began to realize I just wanted to give up intellectuality and learn to come back to love and joy. You know, you can't find happiness by expecting to find it. You've got to be happy to find happiness. There was this man who was a sort of a town grouch in a little village, you might say, in Vermont. And he would snarl at the children and ran across his flower bed, which made them run all the more across his flower bed, shout at the dogs that were digging up his carrots in the backyard, get angry at everything and everyone, and everybody thought of him as just the town grouch. Every town needs, I guess, a grouch, and they felt satisfied having him. Until one day, he came out of his home laughing and singing and full of merriment and happiness, blessing the little children as they ran across his lawn, which stopped them from doing it right away. And finally, the townsfolk just couldn't stand it any longer. And they appointed a committee to go and find out what is wrong with this guy. Why couldn't he be a grouch like before? And so they said to him, well, what's happened to you? And he said, you know, all my life I kept wanting and waiting for something to make me happy. Finally, I realized this world wasn't going to do it for me, so I decided I was just going to be happy anyway. From then on, I've been happy. It's just that simple. It seems crazy, but it really is. You see, we have two aspects of the mind. Intellect, feeling. Too often, we tend to go by intellect. We think by defining. Now, how do you understand that? How do you find that? You can't define happiness. There's no definition for it. It's a self-existent fact of life. It's sort of like Descartes' theory, his explanation for why he knew that he exists. He said, I think, therefore I am. Well, thinking doesn't do it. Really, I mean, you cannot think. As I mentioned the other evening, even worms and mollusks, I don't think they think. They don't seem to be the thinking type. I can't really think of them as intellectuals, nor would I dream of sitting down to a game of chess with a worm or a rhododendron bush. But there is some kind of awareness of existence. A flower points toward the sun. A worm, if you jab it with a pin, will try to get out of the way. A mollusk will try to do something to put itself in a position where it can grab some plankton and munch away or whatever. And so you see that there is this consciousness even without thought. The truth is that we are more conscious when we aren't thinking than when we are. Just take an example. Somebody's watching a sunset and he sees the sunset is absolutely wrapped in its beauty. Somebody sitting next to him says, oh, that's a sunset. Well, first of all, that's the definition. Sort of separates you from the experience by the definition. I think I could paint that one just about that well. Let's see, there's a red there, an orange, maybe a little touch of green. And he goes on with all this analysis. He's not enjoying the sunset. He's just thinking about how he will have joy when he finally paints something that everybody else can admire, which is not really joy anyway, because that's ego. You're happiest when you're not thinking that way. When we were watching that sun going down and the moon coming up, it was a moment of real happiness because there was no thought. Nature was doing enough to keep our minds busy, and we were just completely enraptured in that. The truth is that you're happiest when you don't think, when you're totally aware, when you're totally absorbed. And our moments of that kind of absorption, if we look back over our lives, are very few. Far few and far between. Moments when we could just not have to think about things, just absorb. Well, this is true happiness, when we can be without thought. So Descartes was wrong. He should have said, I am conscious, therefore I am. But the trouble with saying I am conscious, from a scientific point of view, and he'd been trained in science, is that you can't see consciousness. You can't define it. Really, I mean, the dictionary will give you a definition of consciousness, but it's meaningless. Consciousness just is. You have to use consciousness to define anything. It's the subject, and whatever you define is the object. And that subject with which you define that consciousness is the same thing with bliss. You can't define happiness, you can just be happy. The more you define it, the less happy you are. Once you can get back into yourself, the more you find that you just don't know why, but there's a sense of well-being. Now that well-beingness, you see, this is another thing that Yogananda explained. He said there are so many definitions of God that don't have any real direct influence on our desires, on our ability to go anywhere, to grow. You can define God as omnipresent. Doesn't mean that much. You can define him as omniscient. Well, okay, but what does it do? Omnipotent? No, you want something that'll touch you. And if you can understand that God, and the best definition of God is bliss, then you've got something real. And so Yogananda said, think that God is bliss. What is bliss? As I said, you can't really define it, but it's serene happiness is what my dictionary calls it. That's a fairly good definition because there's calmness. In that serene happiness, you feel blissful. You just know that you are that. Well, in the search for happiness, we're also thinking, however, of an abstraction. And it does help to have some sort of mental handle onto which we can hang that idea, that concept of happiness, because otherwise we'll be identifying it with a warm puppy or an ice cream cone or one thing or another. Happiness is not any of those things, it just is. And so it helps also to think of God in some sort of form. Happiness, yes, but a kind of fulfillment. The greatest fulfillment is love. This is why Yogananda's guru, Sri Yukteswar, said that what happens when you can get rid of the meannesses of the heart, the tendency to want to be important, to be looked up to own, to possess, to surround your ego with all sorts of gratification, if you can really understand that the love of the heart is something natural. Actually, the more these meannesses go, the more you begin to feel love automatically. Now, love is a very important thing. Without love, there's no spiritual progress. Sri Yukteswar, who was probably the most wise person that I've ever been able to have some kind of association with in studying his life and so on, he said that you cannot put one foot in front of the other without love. How do you love? I mean, it's possible to love all sorts of things, but if you want to place the label God on that ideal kind of love, there are certain things that are very meaningful to us. What satisfies your deepest desire? Some people are most drawn to God as Father, some to God as friend, beloved. Another form that Yogananda used to talk about is mother. Mother is closer than the father, Yogananda said. Mother is, she always forgives, no matter what you do. She's always on your side, wanting to help you. The father tends to be more according to the law. If you don't go according to his principles and what is true and right by law, he may disown you. The mother could never do that. So the Divine Mother is an aspect of God that is very beautiful. And it's something that several years ago, the idea came to me that I'd like to tour this country talking of God as Divine Mother. It's an aspect of God we need in this country. We need someone who loves us unforgivingly. There's too much thought of God judging you because you've done this and judging you because you've done that and angry because of your being such a sinner. God as Mother could never be angry with you. God as Mother is always on your side, not in your errors, but hoping and praying and wanting to nudge you along toward living a better and a truer life. This is the Mother. I have found that this aspect of Yogananda's teaching is perhaps to me the most beautiful of all, that in loving God as Mother, there comes a yearning that is very difficult to feel for God in any other form. When you love God as your mother, what you really love is not, you don't want somebody who's partial. No, I don't mean it that way. It's a very impersonal love. But I like to think of it this way, that for incarnations, the Divine Mother has given me that love, but I've been the one to ignore it. And now I want to turn back to where I belong. I see that everything else has not given me what I wanted, and yet she's always been there, always watching, always waiting, saying, I will wait. But someday you must come to me, because there isn't any other solution to life. Once you find the love of the Divine Mother, then you feel a completeness. There is no such thing as unrequited love when you give it to God as the Mother. The love aspect of God becomes bliss. Don't love God, don't love the Divine Mother for too personal a reason. That can be an entrapment. It can hold you in, hold you back. But love that is unconditional, love that is expressed primarily as bliss, this kind of love is the kind of love that you find when you attain the Divine Mother. Living with Yogananda, the Divine Mother became a great reality. And I'll never forget one Christmas meditation when he had a vision of God as the Divine Mother. And I remember him saying, oh, Oh, you are so beautiful. And then after a bit, he said, oh, don't go, don't go. And you say the desires of these people are driving you away. Oh, please don't go. Then, but she did go, and he understood why. The Divine Mother can't be there, can't be with you for long. As long as you have the thought that, yeah, but I want this and I want that, don't seek the Mother's love for any other motive than love itself. You will find that in that love is all the fulfillment you've wanted ever. That's why that beautiful song of Ram Prasad, Amondin ki hobe ma tara, will that day come to me, O Mother? When saying your name, my eyes will flow with tears of devotion. Then the lotus of wisdom will blossom forth. Then I will find everything I've been looking. And then it goes on to say, Ore, ore, shotto, 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 ved, tarayamar, nirakara. 1,000 Vedas, 1,000 scriptures declare, my Tara, my Divine Mother, doesn't have any form. Don't think that the Divine Mother just has a form. It may help you in the beginning to think of her that way. But in the end, think of her as without form in everything, in every bush, in every blade of grass, in every sunset, in everything. And you will find that if you can talk to God in that way, and if you can share Him as your very own, that His love is always there. And more you find that He takes you by the hand, she takes you by the hand, and leads you toward what you are seeking. There is no fulfillment in anything except your own self. And the Divine Mother is your own higher self. This is why it's good to understand that the goal of life is bliss itself, not desires fulfilled, not emotional happiness, but this calm bliss that comes from that fulfillment of love. Yes, in the beginning there is emotion because it's hard to separate the two. But indeed, the more you can keep that devotion, that emotion calm, the more it will go toward devotion. When you feel it in your heart, in fact, the Bhagavatam said, think of your heart as a lotus and feel that all the lotus petals are turned up toward the brain. Whatever feeling you have in your heart, direct that feeling upward toward the brain and toward the point between the eyebrows. And if you feel emotion, tears tend to flow, and it's natural. But the more you can keep your feelings calm, the more intense they become. If you can excuse me, if you can calmly direct that love upward, you find that it begins to expand and you become love. It's not so much that you're reaching out toward anything, you're reaching out toward your own self. The spiritual path is really getting to know your own self in the highest way. The Divine Mother is different for every human being. Because you can't say God is this or God is that. He will fulfill the desires of your own heart. And that desire which is the most uplifting, the most exalted in your own self, that desire is what He will come and fulfill. That's why all saints have seen God in unique ways, because each one has a different need. God created each one of us Himself. You are yourself. You have your own song to sing. Through all eternity, no one else will be able to sing that song so well as you. As it says in the Bhagavad Gita, it is better to fail doing your own duty than succeed in doing someone else's duty. Don't let the world tell you what you should be. Learn who you are, because your relationship with God is unique. The scriptures say, the Indian scriptures, that God created us in order to enjoy Himself through many. And alas, there aren't many people He can enjoy Himself through. Because they're still weeping and doing all the wrong things, they don't find that happiness. But those saints who have learned, those saints who have discovered this love in their hearts, he enjoys himself uniquely in everyone. He's waiting for you to find your way of loving him. He's waiting to find, for you to find your relationship with him. Don't think that it has to be as Yogananda's was, or Ramakrishna's was, or St. Francis was. They should give you the inspiration to feel that you have the duty to find this same inspiration in your way, inside yourself. That's why when Yogananda wrote Whispers from Eternity, he said in the foreword to that beautiful book of prayers, he said, the greatest prayer is that which comes from your own heart. The purpose of religion is not to dogmatize you and tell you how you have to be. It's just to sort of prime the pump, to get you moving, to let you make you feel there is inspiration. But after that, don't think, well, how did this one do it and how did that one do it? But try to feel, how does God want to do it through you? If you look at the saints, you'll find every one of them is unique. Each one of them is different. And another wonderful thing you'll see is that although there is so much bitterness, so much suffering, and people often say, why does God, if he loves people, allow them to suffer? It's not that he allows them to suffer. He allows them to discover in their own time and in their own way that suffering is not their reality. Each one has to come out of that darkness of confusion, doubt, to the point where he discovers his own joy. Each one, at the end of his own search, finds that it was worth it. Every moment of it was worth it. That you notice that no saint has ever, after finding God and realizing the presence of God, no saint has ever said, what a scam. Never. They all say it was 1,000, 1,000,000 times worth everything. Because they see then that nothing is real except God's love. And we can define him this way, we can define him that way. God's not going to ask you when you die, were you a good Roman Catholic or a good Hindu or a good Muslim or Buddhist? He's going to say, how much do you love me? And if you love him, he won't have to say anything. Because in real love, there is only silence. As Yogananda, in one of his prayers, in Whispers from Eternity, said, oh, how maddening. I can pray no more with words, but only with wistful yearnings of my heart. And so also Saint Teresa of Avila said that in the stages of prayer, you reach a point where the mind can't think anymore. The mind can't define. It can't even have the thought, I am loving you. It's just love. You want to go beyond thoughts, beyond definitions. You want to merge in love itself. And when you have that, no one can teach you anything. There is this beautiful story about Namdev. I've written this story in The Path, and those of you who have read The Path will no doubt remember the story. But there were two saints in a town, in a small town, and one was called Namdev, and I don't remember the others, but the other was a potter saint. That is to say, he was a saint, but his profession was pottery. And one time there was a big festival, and all sorts of people came to this festival, 5,000 people from all over, and the potter, as is the way of potters, decided to find out if there were any cracks in these pots. And so he was going around, but because everybody had devotion to him, they let him have his way. So he'd go around and slap people on the face, and they'd just take it. Until he came to Namdev. Well, those people revered Namdev as a saint, and he had enough little ego there to think, well, who's he to teach me? And so when this potter slapped him too, he said, "What'd you do that for?" And the potter calmly stood up. He said, "There seems to be a crack in this pot." Everybody laughed. And so afterwards, Namdev, who was able to commune with God, and his particular way of devotion was through Krishna. So he went to the temple and he prayed to the image of Krishna. And mind you, there's a difference between idols and icons. Idol worship, idols are things like wealth, greed, lust, power. Those are idols. But to have an image that makes you think of God, this is not an idol, it's an icon. Even Muslims, this is something that Kabir pointed out, not Kabir, Nanak pointed out in Punjab. He said, "You say no images, and yet you all bow to Mecca, to that stone in Mecca. You need images. Everybody needs an image of some sort." And so the image that he worshipped was God in the form of Krishna, but it was not an idol, because he was only worshipping God in that form, and his love was expanding, not contracting. And so he went to Krishna and bowed before him, and he said, "Lord, why did you let me be so embarrassed in front of all these devotees?" And Krishna's answer was, "Well, I can't help it. There is a crack in that pot." Well, Namdev was not an egotist. He was humble, and he wanted to learn. He said, "Lord, if there is, then I want to be perfect in your sight. And so help me to understand." And Krishna said, "Well, I can appear to you in vision, but I can't teach you. I can't give you that touch. What you need for that is a guru." And he said, "But I see you. What do I need with a guru?" He said, "No, this is my law. You have to go to somebody who has that consciousness. I can't give it to you directly. It's not my way. I do everything through instruments." So he said, "Well, Lord, then at least tell me where to go." And so he told him about this other village, about this man. He said, don't worry if he seems a little strange. That's just his way." Well, he went to the village, and he found these people there, and he asked them, where is so-and-so? "Oh, that crazy fool. Yeah, you'll probably, what would anybody want anything to do with him for? But anyway, you'll probably find him up by the temple somewhere. He always hangs out there." They just thought of him as a bum. You know, a lot of saints don't want you to know who they are. They don't want to be bothered. As Babaji one time said to Pranabananda, when Pranabananda met him for the first time, and he said, "But where's your holy robe?" He just had come into Lahiri Maharshai's home with his dhoti all wet from taking a bath in the Ganges. And he was a young-looking man, seemed to be about 24 years old. Lahiri Maharshai was an older man, 60 years old or so. And Lahiri Maharshai was bowing before him in great devotion. And Pranabananda looked at him and he said, "Well, what's this all about? How can you, an older man, bow to this youngster?" And Lahiri Maharshai said, "Get down, this is my guru. This is Babaji." And so he sort of, "All right." But then he wanted to ask him. He said, "Well, what's this with a..." He said, "Why are you so young?" He said, "Oh, many kalpas have seen this body." In other words, "I have been in this body a long time. I have kept its youthful appearance." But then he said, "Well, where is your holy robe, Nirgeru, or no, your orange robe?" He said, "You know those holy bulls in the marketplace? The priests put a special mark on them to let the public know that they've been blessed, and everybody goes and touches them and thinks he's going to get some sort of blessing that way." He said, "I'm no holy bull. I don't want to be bothered by people. So I go like this." Well, in this way, many saints often will try not to be perceived as different from anybody else, because they don't want to be bothered by just curiosity seekers. I visited a great saint in India one time, and he was talking to me about spiritual matters, and he said, "You know, it's your good karma that leads me to talk about these things, but you ask anybody here in this village, they just talk to me about diet, and they don't know these things, and I don't talk about them." So anyway, Namdev went to this temple, and he saw an old hobo kind of person lying on the floor, sort of limp, with his legs, his feet pointing toward the altar. Well, in India, this is an unthinkable sacrilege, to put your feet toward the altar. It's just not done. And you don't sit in the presence of an elder or a superior being or anything with your feet pointing toward him. It's just a symbol of disrespect. And Namdev, who was this devotee, said, "Take your feet away from the altar." And the other man said, "Well, you see, my child, I'm getting old. It's difficult for me to move. Would you please move my feet where there isn't the altar?" So Namdev took his feet and started to put them down, when there was the altar. And he moved them, there was the altar. And wherever he moved his feet, there was the altar. And finally he realized, uh-oh. This man's very different from what I thought. And finally he said, "You must be the man I've come to look for, to be my guru." And the man stood up then, very different. He blessed him, and Namdev went into samadhi, because he was a great soul already, and it didn't take much, but it needed that touch. And then he was roaming the countryside and just always drunk with Krishna, always drunk with the presence of God. And one day he happened to be near his old town, and he thought for old time's sake he'd go to that temple. And he did, and he prostrated before the temple, and Krishna appeared to him in a vision. And Krishna said, "My son, I've missed you. Where have you been?" to test him. And Namdev said, "Lord, everywhere I look, I see you. How would I think to come just here to see you when I see you everywhere?" And Krishna smiled. He said, "Now there are no cracks in that pot." When you understand that God is everywhere, then you can be like Ram Prasad. Divine Mother is everywhere. But to get to that stage, you do need help. And those people who think that they can get it without God, without a guru, without any kind of teaching and teacher, they're right idealistically, wrong practically. The thing is that when you're locked in the ego, this is an immense chasm between being an ego, which is one little spot in this universe, one little atom. You know, you're not even omnipresent in your body. I hit my hand, and I don't feel it in my hand, I feel it in my brain. Everything my body feels is really in my brain. Everything is referred back to the ego. The ego is the perceiver. And the chitta, which is here in the heart, is what says I like it or I don't like it. In fact, well, I could go into that. I'm not going to now. To explain the difference between ego, intellect, chitta, feeling, and so on. Very interesting, not tonight's subject. But you need to come to that point where you can somehow bridge that little tiny atom which sees itself separate from others. And in a way, yes, you can increase your identity through empathy, serving other people, being humble and not thinking, "I'm so important, I'm so bright, I'm so intelligent." Leave that thought of I. It's a curse. It's your greatest aid. Yes, it's an aid in the beginning, and then your greatest obstruction. And if you can leave that thought altogether, why is it an aid? Because you need to know that you're the one suffering. If it was just sort of suffering, you wouldn't do anything about it. Once you realize I'm in pain, that's when you start thinking, I've got to do something about it. But what you've got to do is get rid of that thought of I. And once you get rid of it, there isn't any pain. And so you learn to love others, to serve others, to give to others. We do this in our community. We have a wonderful laboratory there. Because we see those who live that way are the ones who are always happier. And those who think first, me, 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 are always unhappy and usually more and more unhappy. And so that's one way of breaking the ego, but it's a very slow process. I mean, so you love your own family, then you love your neighbors, then you love your town, and then your country. Okay, the French. And so on. It just takes forever that way. It's a necessary practice, but it won't really do it for you alone. What you need is to be in tune with somebody who has that consciousness. He is the plane, the airplane, that can take you over the abyss to cosmic consciousness. And that is how and why the Indian teachings say that the greatest of all possible blessings in all the universes is a God-known guru. One who has that consciousness, who can give you that. Now, mind you, there are gradations in everything. Anybody who has more of it can give you more than somebody who has less of it. That seems fairly obvious. Mix with people who have an uplifted state of consciousness. Mix with people who are devoted to truth and not with people who think that all they really want is money and power and all the worldly pleasures. Mix with people who have something of this inner peace. You know, Yogananda was on a train one time, and there was a man there. He was a black man, acting as the waiter in the restaurant. And Yogananda saw that he was a very sincere person. And one time, Yogananda had to sit at another table, and this man actually was so sad that he was weeping. And he finally came up to Yogananda. He said, "What have you got that I want?" And Yogananda said, "Come see me." And so he sought him out afterwards, and Yogananda touched him and blessed him and gave him a technique of meditation. But it's only from somebody who has it that you can get it. It takes a match that'll strike inspiration that sort of pushed them on the path of their own evolution, that uplifted them. Everybody must have had somebody like that. Well, look for people like that. And look above all for people who have more of it. Because, you know, most of those people, once you get to know them better, yeah, a little bit here and there, a little. They have something, but not much. People don't have much. I tell you the truth. I couldn't imagine myself ever saying to anybody, "I want to be your disciple." Unthinkable. I looked around me and I saw a bunch of fools. I didn't exclude myself. I was a fool. And I thought, I don't want to be a fool, and I don't want to become wise by going to other people who just pretend to have something that I don't see that they've got. It's not real. I didn't know anything about saints. If only I'd known, but I didn't. I had to think my way through it because I was going by the way of intellect. I remember one night taking a long walk. This was down in Charleston, South Carolina, where I was studying to be a playwright. And I thought, what is God? What can God be? Obviously, he can't be a policeman on a cloud. That doesn't make sense. What is he? I said, well, who am I that can ask such a question? Surely the fact that I can even ask such a question means that I have an aspiration. And the fact that I have this aspiration means that I must be aspiring towards something conscious. God has to be consciousness. And my inspiration is more when I'm in tune with that and less when I forget it. And looking back over my brief life, I saw that was the case. I saw that the more I lived in a search for this attunement with something larger, some larger consciousness, the more I felt a fulfillment. The more I thought of me and forgetting other people, the less I felt of it. And I remember going home from that walk just staggered with the immensity of that realization that the purpose of life, whatever we do, is to come to the point where we are more in tune with that infinite consciousness. That our joy is in touch with that infinite joy, and our love in touch with that infinite love. And yet I found that I couldn't get a hold of it until I found Yogananda's book. Now, Asha told you about my finding it. It was very interesting. My father had been posted to Egypt, where he was an oil geologist for Esso, and my mother was to go and join him. The day I put her on the ship to go to Egypt and join him, she'd already gone off to sea was on the high seas, and I went up Fifth Avenue in New York. And I went into Doubleday Duran, is what they called it in those days. And I was interested in Indian teaching. Somebody had told me something about the Bhagavad Gita. It sounded like a very exotic name, but it attracted me. And I had read a few little things about meditation. I thought, this is for me. And as Asha told you, I was thinking of going abroad and to South America where I could live more cheaply and meditate, but I didn't know what meditation was. And then I happened to see Autobiography of a Yogi. Now, I have to admit, I didn't seize on it right away. I loved that picture. It was so beautiful. I was very attracted to it. But at the same time, I opened it up and it said, dedicated to Luther Burbank, an American saint. I said, oh, an American saint. Ridiculous. How can there be an American saint? All I'd ever seen of America was money, money, money. This, I didn't want that. And so I decided I wouldn't do that. And I bought the Bhagavad Gita. And I took it to our... I was renting a room in a home in Scarsdale. And I was trying to get a job on a ship where I could save money, make a lot of money, not have a chance to spend it, and so build up a bit of a bank account so I could go to South America and meditate until I found what I thought was peace of mind. That's all I hoped to get. I just had no peace. I thought, enough if I can just get peace. And I remembered as I was crossing the street, I think it was 50th Street, to go down to Bowling Green to see if a ship had come in that I could get on, when I felt almost like a voice in my head saying, what about the Autobiography of a Yogi? And I thought, no, I've read too much, I'm too intellectual, I've got to save money, why keep spending it? And so I was all, really, I started in the direction toward the subway when I felt a force turning me left. And I thought, well, I didn't make this decision. And I began to get excited. I thought, who made this decision for me? And I began to get more and more excited. And I went to Doubleday Duran and bought this book. And I happened to meet a Scarsdale. I went to Scarsdale High. My parents lived in Scarsdale. He was a friend from Scarsdale High. And he was talking to me in glowing terms about the great career he had before him in television. And the more he talked this way, the more I clutched this book to my heart. I thought, oh, none of that world for me. And I took the book home, and between tears and laughter, I was just so drunk with joy. I took the next bus from New York to Los Angeles, 4 days and four nights. I went to Yogananda. I never thought in my life I would address these words to anyone. But when I met him, my first words were, I want to be your disciple. I've never, in all these years, 54 years, I've never for one moment doubted the wisdom of that decision. I've had many doubts, never that one. I knew this was my life, and I've met many great saints. Always meeting them only made me love my own guru the more. Because God came to me through him. It isn't that God is greater here or greater there. He's the same everywhere. But when you found, just like there are many wonderful women, but we always love our own mother in a very special way. And so also, you can't help loving your own guru because this is what God has given to you. And so living with him, you know, they say that no man is great in the eyes of his own valet, or valet, as they'd say in England. But in Yogananda's case, it was the opposite. Those who were closest to him held him in the highest reverence. I never saw him anything except just perfection itself. That doesn't mean he always followed my definitions of perfection. Far from it. But I always found out that it was my definitions that were deficient. That he was always greater than I thought greatness ought to be. He was more open, more loving, more, I don't know, it was just an incredible experience. Now, I know that I've had an experience none of you can have. I'm the only one in this room and the only one among very few still living who knew him. I don't want for a moment to say, well, gee, look at me, how lucky I am. Not at all. I hope through my life, through what I've done, to help you to understand that he's just as much alive today as he was then. I said to him once, will you be as much with us after you are gone as you are now? He said, to those who think me near, I will be near. And I found it to be true. But it's wonderful. It's not just my own private possession. I see that the more people tune in with his ray, the more this light begins to come out. So I see, and it's very nice for me, hundreds of Yoganandas everywhere. Because every one of you shines to a greater or lesser degree with his light. When you are seeking God, yes, God is in you. Yes, God is something infinite. All of these things, yes. But also, the way he manifests through the Guru, the way he manifests to each one of us, is something that this is yours. I remember there was one disciple who betrayed Yogananda, turned against him, tried to ruin him financially. This happens. Jesus had his Judas. These things happen. Yogananda every year would send him a box of mangoes. He was an Indian. So he would send him a box of mangoes. And this man, without even touching them, without opening them, would always send them back. Yogananda said, he will never find God except through this channel, which was given to him by God. This is the law. You can't choose the Guru. God chooses through the Guru. God chooses you. But I have to say, without any desire to convert anyone, doesn't mean a thing to me. I want to convert you to your own higher self. But if you do feel an attunement, if you do feel an attraction and some kind of bond, then don't hold back just because of ego and say, well, I got to protect myself, because honestly, the more you can give yourself to that, the more you find your fulfillment. And the more you think, well, I got to be me, the less me you are. People are imitators. I remember a couple of little children, 5, 6 years old, crossing the tennis court at Mount Washington, and the little boy had probably seen a John Wayne movie or something like that, because I called ahead to the girl, come here, little piping voice. I'm not going to listen to you, Johnny, kind of thing. I said, come here. That kind of attitude. As long as you have that I want to be the king of the roost, I want to control other people, I'm the boss. Hollywood teaches you that. And you learn very bad lessons that way. The more you can be humble, I found such sweetness in just getting rid of this stupid self and realizing that it was all, he was the one, God is the one. I remember one time I had a big tussle in my meditation, and I finally just decided, I'm not this. I don't want anything to do with it. And it was sort of a breakthrough. We all have these periods, but this was a real thing for me. And Yogananda was outside by the tennis courts at that time, looking out over the city of Los Angeles. So I went to him and bowed before him, and he tapped me on the forehead. He said, very good. He knew our thoughts. He understood. But when you have that, God will say very good in your own heart. That's what you've got to look for that smile inside, worth 1,000 ice cream cones, worth 1,000 earthly fulfillments. The more you have that divine smile in your heart, and it comes from your own higher self, the more you will know that's what life is all about. Learn to love God. Learn to serve God. Learn to get rid of this stupid thought that you are anything. And you will find that when you can desire to be nothing, you suddenly realize you are everything. It is not a diminishment of power. It's an incredible increase of power, wisdom, understanding, love. You're simply reclaiming your own birthright when you can give up the little ego and discover that your true self is the self of all. That is what you are. You are the divine self in everything. Joy to you.